Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 345 for November 27th, 2011. Support for Whiskey Cask comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at redbreastwhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. Coming up in a few minutes.
There's ghosts everywhere. I keep looking up the chimney to see if Pappy's going to drop down for Christmas. Maybe he will. I will wait quietly.
That's Tom Bullitt of Bullitt Bourbon. His office at the old Stitzel Weller Distillery in Louisville is the same one used by the legendary Pappy Van Winkle. Stitzel Weller was mothballed in 1991 by what was then United Distillers, now part of Diageo, which still uses the warehouses to mature Bullitt Bourbon and is in the early stages of opening at least part of the facility to visitors for the first time since 1991. Much more on that later on. We'll get the history of the old place from bourbon historian Michael Veach. Pappy's grandson, Julian Van Winkle, will share some of his memories with us. And Tom Bullitt will tell us about the plans for the future at Stitzel Weller. I'll also have the calendar of events, the emails of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the week's news. As always, it's brought to you by Glenmorangie. It's a light week because of the Thanksgiving holiday in the U.S., so let's start off with a few new releases. Highland Park usually announces a new expression in its Orcadian Vintages series around this time every year. This year, there are two expressions. The 1971 vintage came from 17 casks and is bottled at 46.7% ABV. It's priced at £2,300, or around $3,600 a bottle. Just 657 bottles are being released worldwide. The 1976 vintage came from a mix of 13 sherry butts and hogsheads and produced 893 barrels at 49.1% ABV. It's priced at £2,000, or $3,100 a bottle. I received samples of both this week, and I'll have tasting notes for the 1976 vintage later in this episode. Unfortunately, the Angels managed to drain the entire 1971 sample in transit. It happens sometimes. In past episodes, I've mentioned the Blogger's Blend project that Master of Malt invited me to be part of earlier this year. They provided 10 whiskey writers and bloggers with a blending kit of various malts and grains and asked each of us to come up with our own personal blend. This summer, Master of Malt customers voted on the 10 anonymous samples. The winning blend has now been bottled as St. Isidore, named after the patron saint of the Internet. The label features a bunch of hidden Internet references as well, but the one thing it doesn't have is who created the winning blend. That is being kept a secret, even from us. It's available exclusively through Master of Malt, which is also releasing a blending kit similar to the one we used for this project, as well as a custom whiskey blending service. Full disclosure, none of the writers and bloggers involved in the project received any compensation for participating. For me, the education alone was well worth it. Now, our good friend Jim Martin of the Malted Muse podcast was not part of the Master of Malt project. Instead, he went out and bottled his own whiskey. He was able to acquire a 15-year-old cask of Tobermory single malt and has bottled it at a cask strength 57.1% ABV. He's named it The Home Calling and is selling it exclusively through his website. And while we're talking about whiskey bloggers and writers, I want to congratulate my good friend Serge Valentin of the Malt Maniacs and WhiskeyFun.com. Serge just finished writing his 7,500th tasting note. That's a lot of tasting over the last 10 years or so. Well done, Serge. And by the way, I mentioned the Whiskey Magazine U.S. Icons of Whiskey Awards a couple of weeks ago. There was one category not announced at the awards luncheon in Louisville. David Blackmore of Glenmorangie won the award for Scotch Whiskey Ambassador of the Year, while Heather Green of Glenfiddich was named the highly commended runner-up. Congratulations to both. In other news, Scotch Whiskey Association CEO Sir Gavin Hewitt has been named president of the European Spirits Organization. The group is made up of 30 national associations representing spirits producers in 26 European countries. He'll serve 2 years as president while continuing his work at the SWA. And finally, Wild Turkey's Jimmy Russell has offered to put a couple of real turkeys to work. Earlier this week, President Barack Obama carried out the White House tradition of pardoning two turkeys on the day before Thanksgiving. The birds, named Liberty and Peace, have been sent to Mount Vernon to live out their lives on exhibit. But Jimmy told ABC News he'd love to have them as the Wild Turkey's official spokesbirds and live at the distillery. Jimmy told ABC there are plenty of wild turkeys in the area around the distillery in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, but you never see them. That's especially true this time of year. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Let's open up the inbox for the comments of the week now, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. First off, we need some help from listeners in the Denver area. Jeffrey Steuben is heading that way and needs recommendations on good whiskey bars and shops. Ray Weaver asked the same question about good whiskey shops as well. I don't have a good handle on retailers in the Denver area, but Pints Pub in Denver claims to have one of the largest selections of single malts around. I've suggested that Jeffrey check that claim out and report back to us. Meanwhile, Michael Caldwell posted a question on our Facebook page about royal warrants. Those are the seals that appear on some whiskey bottles, indicating that they're officially endorsed as a supplier to Britain's royal family. Royal warrants are issued in all kinds of categories, everything right down to plumbers who work at Buckingham Palace at times. And here's what Michael had to say. Hey, Mark, I was explaining the royal warrants that are printed on many Scotch labels to some friends and noticed that there is no definitive guide on the internet for this subject. At least, I couldn't find one. Do you know of a site that tracks which royal warranted which Scotch? Well, there's no specific site that tracks royal warrants throughout history, but royalwarrants.org is the site for the Royal Warrant Holders Association, and it has the current lineup. Right now, only Queen Elizabeth, Prince Philip, and Prince Charles issue royal warrants. The only whiskey-related warrant that Charles has issued is to Laphroaig. The Queen has issued warrants to Johnny Walker, Dewars, the famous Grouse, and William Sanderson and Son, which is part of Diageo, and Berry Brothers and Rudd holds a warrant as an official wine and spirits merchant. It's the only one to have that category. There are a bunch of wine merchants listed, but no one else in the spirits category. Finally, Hansa Spirit 2012 is coming up in Hamburg, Germany in February. Chris Rickert is one of the organizers, and he posted a video of their promotional film for the festival on the Facebook page. If you've ever tried to explain the flavors in whiskey to someone, you need to take a look at this video. It's very well done. If you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, well, you can always post it on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Or if you're not on Facebook, just email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker, now offering custom engraving on your gift bottles of Johnny Walker Blue Label for the holidays. Get more details at your local retailer or johnnywalker.com. If you're looking for the perfect holiday gift, I hope you'll take a look at the WhiskeyCast website and my photo gallery. I've lowered shipping costs for the holidays, and if you place your order by December 10th, I'll do everything I can to make sure your prints arrive in time for Christmas. Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. Lots of holiday-related events kicking off this week. Maker's Mark will hold its annual candlelight holiday tours of the distillery from December 1st through the 10th in Loretto, Kentucky. Buffalo Trace will have its holiday lighting celebration on December 1st in Frankfurt. And Woodford Reserve will have its annual holiday open house December 9th through the 11th in Versailles, Kentucky. Whiskey Ship is this coming weekend in Zurich, Switzerland. The next Universal Whiskey Experience Dalmore Dinner is December 5th in Calgary, Alberta, followed by the 7th in Dallas. Jim McEwen of Brook Laddie will lead a tasting on December 9th in Leuven, Belgium. And a few tickets are still available for the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Hogmanay tastings on New Year's Eve at the Vaults in Leith and the Members' Rooms in Edinburgh, Scotland. Those are just some of the events coming up over the next few weeks. You'll find a full calendar at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at Laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
Whiskey Cast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Barry Crockett, master distiller, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
The Irish pot still whiskey category, it's the unique story of Irish distilling practice. Its flavour and characteristics can be summarised to two particular factors. Firstly, the use of barley, which is harvested here locally, gives a particular aroma of what I describe as apple, verging towards pear, and indeed even a peach taste and aroma. And of course, this can be also categorised as a spirit which is very, very aromatic and sweet. In terms of taste, the barley gives, again, what I would describe as a velvety, soft, syrup-like effect on the palate. So it's a very rounded finish, very smooth. And again, this really arises from the use of very high percentages of barley in the brewing mix.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
Time now for Whiskey Cast in Depth. The Stitzel Weller Distillery on the outskirts of Louisville, in the town of Shively, actually, has been closed for about 20 years now. It's regarded as a mystical place by bourbon connoisseurs, and about as hard to visit as Fort Knox down the road. That's about to change, though. Not at Fort Knox, but at Stitzel Weller. Diageo is in the early stages of creating the Bullet experience at Stitzel Weller. Right now it's used for staff training and special guests, but the plan is to make it a full-fledged stop on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. More on that in a few minutes. But first, let's look at what makes Stitzel Weller so special in bourbon history. Michael Veach is the bourbon historian at Louisville's Filson Historical Society.
The distillery was opened in 1935 on Derby Day, but it was there were three partners in it. There was Julian P. Van Winkle, Alex T. Farnsley, and Arthur Philip Stitzel. And I would say Stitzel had as much to do about the actual making of the distillery itself as anybody, probably more than Pappy. Because, you know, Stitzel was the distiller, and Pappy was the salesman, and Alex T. Farnsley was the money man, basically. So, early on, the three of them were inseparable as far as looking at, you know, the necessity to that distillery. As a matter of fact, I have a photograph at home somewhere, or a copy of a photograph that I call the Big Three, because it is the three of them, Julian P. Van Winkle, Alex Farnsley, and Arthur Philip Stitzel, sitting in the office there at Stitzel Weller, and they look so much like, you know, the photograph of Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin.
Tell me about Stitzel, because his name's on the place, but we don't hear about him very much anymore.
Well, he was the distiller. He was the one. He comes from the Stitzel family, which started a distillery here in the 1870s, Stitzel Brothers Distillery. Frederick Stitzel is, every time you walk into a warehouse and you see those rickings, that was designed and patented by Frederick Stitzel. And as a matter of fact, we have his patent model here at the Filson. And they were quite successful at distilling. Their brands were Glencoe and Fortuna, and they ended up selling out to the Hollenbach family, and anybody here in Louisville will recognize that name because it's been a prominent family since then. And then Arthur Philip Stitzel kind of went on his own and built a distillery. I think it opened in 1902, and that was down on Story Avenue, right where Main Street and Story Avenue come together. And he was quite good at making whiskey, and W.L. Weller and Son started contracting with him in the first decade, 19-teens, right along in there. Started having him make their whiskey for him and for them, and then they eventually formed a partnership, sort of, during Prohibition. They weren't legally partners in that W.L. Weller and Stitzel Distillery was not merged, but Stitzel Distillery had Stitzel as president Alex T. Farnsley is vice president and Julian P. Van Winkle is secretary treasurer. W.L. Weller and Son had Julian P. Van Winkle as president, Alex T. Farnsley as vice president, and Stitzel as secretary treasurer. So even though they weren't officially merged during Prohibition, they were definitely, you know, the same company. And it was after, right after Prohibition, that they merged together to form Stitzel Weller Distillery. And there are letters in the archive there at Stitzel Weller where Pappy says that the recipe that they're using to make their whiskey in 1935 was a recipe that the Stitzel family had been experimenting with for years, and they felt that it was now perfected and that it gave a better tasting whiskey at a younger age. And that's basically the weeded recipe that they became famous for.
And that Pappy's son Julian is making now Buffalo Trace for the most part, right? Yeah.
Well, grandson.
Grandson, right.
Yeah.
How did these three come to take control of the Weller name?
Well, W.L. Weller and Sons, of course, was formed in 1849. And actually, it was W.L. Weller and Brother. So his younger brother, Charles Weller, was his original partner. And it was that way all the way up until 1862 or 63, I forget right off the top of my head, but it was one of those 2 years when Charles, with another man, was down in Tennessee collecting bills, and they were robbed and murdered. So for the rest of the years of the war, Weller was partnered with a guy named Buckner, which was interesting because Weller's younger brother, John Weller, was serving under General Buckner in the Confederate Army at the same time. Don't know if there was a connection between the two, but it is a coincidence, something that would be interesting to find out. But after the war, Buckner leaves the firm. George Weller becomes the son and W.L. Weller and Son. Eventually, he gets a couple of other sons that join the company, and it becomes W.L. Weller and Sons. Well, Weller retires right not too long after Pappy Van Winkle joins the company as a salesman. Alex T. Farnsley was already a salesman in the company. And he dies very shortly afterwards. He dies in 1899. Well, around, I think it's 1903, the family was getting to an age where they were thinking about they were ready to retire, move on to other things. And Farnsley and Van Winkle bought controlling interest of the company, even though George Weller was still listed as the president of the company all the way up until 1920. But those two end up getting control of the company, buying control, and that's how it became W.L. Weller and Sons. And like I said, during Prohibition, they merged with Stitzel. And
how did the distillery come to close? What, in later history, what happened eventually that forced it to go to close down?
They got bought up by Guinness, basically, what is now Diageo, United Distillers at that time. And the United Distillers also bought the Shinley Company, and they had distilleries in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, and at downtown at Bernheim, and at Stitzel Weller, and then George Dickel. And they decided that they didn't need all those distilleries, so they decided to build Bernheim as a big distillery that could handle all of the whiskey making they needed done, and close Stitzel Weller down. My personal opinion is that the people in charge of United Distillers were not all the brightest people in the world when it came to the business. They had the best portfolio of bourbons in the world when I was with them in 1992, started full-time in 1992, and they basically sold it all off, and they closed that distillery. You know, and if they had half a brain amongst them, they would realize that bottles of Stitzel Weller whiskey is selling for $500 to $1,500 a bottle on eBay, that they could open that distillery, and if they made the whiskey right, you know, made it like it used to be made, they could name their price on a bottle of bourbon, and they could call it Old Stitzel Weller and sell it.
Julian Van Winkle is Pappy's grandson and the keeper of the Van Winkle family's bourbon heritage. Stitzel Weller wasn't just a distillery to him.
You know, I grew up there, so it was pretty special to us and my sisters and cousins growing up there, and it was a pretty neat place. So it was really sad to see it shut down, and they were also making the world's best bourbon as far as I was concerned at the time, so it didn't make any sense, but I hope they keep it going.
What was it like growing up around the old Stitzel Weller distillery?
It was very, my dad knew everybody that worked there, and I knew a lot of the people that worked there, and I worked there for several summers, and it was cool. It was neat. It was, you know, my dad kept his bird dogs there. Pappy kept his bird dogs there, and just kind of a little family operation. It's a lot smaller than everybody else at the time, so it was very special.
Was there anything that stood out about the distillery and just the way that, just how unique it was compared to all the other distilleries, the bourbon distilleries here in Kentucky?
Probably the scale of it. It was smaller. Of course, when Maker's Mark came around, it was smaller than Stitzel Weller, but just seemed to be a lot smaller, and did things a little differently as far as using wheat and a roller mill and propagating their own yeast and so forth. So it was a lot of different things.
And that's where the wheated bourbons really came from originally, right?
Well, not originally. They were made before Prohibition. Actually, we think the Stitzel Distillery, or maybe even the old Fitzgerald Distillery. We're not sure where Pappy got the idea to use wheat, but it was before they opened up in 1935. They were still making wheated bourbon before that.
How good were the whiskeys from that old place?
Really good. I've still got some, and they're better than anything that's out there today. For my palate, they are. Some people are used to what's being sold today, but they were just very different. Just creamy and smooth, and just a different level, really. And anybody that's tasted, I use them in auctions and special events. I've got a few bottles, and anybody else that tastes them tends to agree.
What was the difference? Was it the stills? Was it the shape of the stills? Was it the yeast? Was it the grains? What made the difference there?
Probably a combination of the yeast, the equipment, the stills, the water, milling the grain differently, the distillation proof, entry proof, all those different things was all different than what's done today. So I think all those in combination had a lot to do with it.
Do you think if they ever do wind up distilling there again that they'll be able to produce spirit that compares to the old stuff?
I don't think so. It's hard to say. You know, it's with the variables the way they were, the way they made them. You know, if they don't use the same water and the same yeast and mill the grain the same way, you know, just by using the same formula and the same equipment, it may not. Who knows if it'll be the same whiskey? But until they do it, we'll never really know.
How close are the current Pappy Van Winkles to the old stuff?
Well, what was made at Stitzel Weller before they closed, and the Buffalo Trace distillation is very close, which we're very pleased with that. So we're happy about that. They actually made some bourbon for Weller back in the late 90s, and we sold some of that under a label that's 15 years old, and it was very good. So it's pretty close.
What would it mean to you and to your family's legacy to actually see people be able to go into Stitzel Weller again?
That'd be great. You know, I've always wanted Diageo to crack that place back open again. So it's sooner the better as far as I'm concerned. But, yeah, if they could get it going again, that'd be great because it was part of great bourbon history, and it's too bad to have it just sitting there.
It's been 25 years since Tom Bullitt decided to blow the dust off of his great-great-grandfather's bourbon recipe and get back into the whiskey business. For most of those years, Stitzel Weller served quietly as a place for Bullitt bourbon to age, behind a gate with a guard to keep the public away. A couple of weeks ago, the guard let me in to talk with Tom about the next chapter in the story of Stitzel Weller. It starts with a small orange sign that hangs from the main Stitzel Weller sign in front of the office. The sign reads, "The Bullitt Experience."
Bullitt Bourbon is about to get a new home, from what I understand, here at Stitzel Weller. What is the overall plan to turn Stitzel Weller into what's being called the Bullitt Experience?
Well, it's actually, Bulleit is getting sort of a new home, and Bulleit is, of course, we make our bourbon in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, and our rye in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. So the facilities are the same where we've always made the bourbon, and now we make the rye. Of course, we've been making it for quite a while. But we're going to have an office out of here now, the Stitzer-Weller offices, as does the North American supply and whiskey team for Diageo. So it's a logical place, sort of a logical place to run our business from. As you know, you were just downtown at the Sealback. My grandfather lived at the Sealback. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not. And
I have to tell you that story. We'll go off the record, and I'll tell you that story. But we manage our so Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, over this way, Lawrenceburg, Indiana, over that way. We're bottling. We moved our bottling from Relay, Maryland, into Lawrenceburg, Indiana, into LDI, and all of it now. And then we're aging some here and some in Cox's Creek, Kentucky. So this is a sort of logical place to run our business from. It's right here in Louisville where I grew up and close to a bunch of things. And as far as an evolution goes, we have stage 1.5 at this point of 2 of 68 stages or whatever as we take over the state of Kentucky. But in due course, we will have at this point, because you're here, trade people come in and our guests. So we have a place to entertain here, as we're going to see here in just a minute. We'll walk around, look at the place. And then we will evolve in due course to be on the Bourbon Trail. So and then have a visitor's center, maybe something like Max has out in Bardstown, Max Shapiro at Heaven Hill. And where the industry's sort of going to visitor centers at this point. So we're certainly looking forward to that. At that point, we'll have customers in, but this point sort of for entertaining and the trade and for you very specifically.
Now, the office we're in your office.
Yes.
Is it fair to say this was Pappy's office at one time?
Well, it's more than fair. It was. It was. We were just downtown at Icons, Icons of a Whiskey Ceremony, Whiskey Magazine, which was delightful at the Sealback. Julian and Preston Van Winkle were there, old dear friends. And we were talking about the presence of this office and the wonderful history of it. That's exactly right. This is where Pappy Van Winkle sat when he ran Old Fitzgerald.
And how much of the furniture? Is any of this still original, or did you leave it alone?
Actually, the furniture is our family's, generationally our family's. I don't know that I'll have to ask. I don't know if there is any furniture from that era. I don't think there is. All of these things came out of our family generationally. For instance, you are standing next to a chest on chest that is not even mine. It's my son's, who's in college. His grandmother left it to him. So I said, "You don't want to take that to college, do you, Tucker?" I said, and certainly the drawers, it's old, so it would not be a college sort of thing.
Now, this is really the next evolution in the Bulleit Bourbon brand, to have a home of your own, because, as you pointed out, the whiskey's been produced at LDI for the rye, right, and at a distillery in Lawrenceburg for the bourbon.
Correct.
And while the way I understand it, the distillery here will not reopen and it won't be put into service, or am I wrong on that? Is there a possibility of reopening this to produce Bulleit at some point?
No, there are no plans on doing that at this point. We are absolutely delighted with all of the people making our whiskey and where we have been historically. All of it is part of the old Seagram's infrastructure. As you know, we partnered with Seagram's in the mid-90s, and Diageo bought most of Seagram's. And our production and supply infrastructure still is in the old Seagram's facilities. As a matter of fact, I am so delighted about it that when I talk about the components and the ingredients of Bulleit, one of the ingredients I include is the expertise of the people who make it. So I don't think we have current plans, and I doubt that this still would be opened. The still itself is in mothball, but this is one of Diageo's primary aging facilities and officing facilities.
So all the warehouses are still here and still being used to age your whiskey, but it'll never be produced here again, probably.
Well, you never say never. That's at my age. If you say never, you've been run over by a truck. If I would have said never, I don't know. But it is a very substantial aging facility. I think there is. I don't know the exact numbers. It's probably something in excess of 500,000 barrels of whiskey here.
But over time, eventually, the public will eventually get to see this place, hopefully at some point 10, 15 years down the road or sooner.
It'll be a lot sooner than that. I think within the next 2 or 3 years, we'll have for sure, we'll be on the Bourbon Trail, and we'll be have people coming in and welcome them. And I think we'll, as everybody on the Bourbon Trail would tell you, we're all ambassadors for bourbon and for Kentucky and for the industry. So we would be delighted to do our part on the Bourbon Trail and show them what it's like here at Stitzel Weller. It's a wonderful old historic distillery.
Tell me some of the things you think about when you're walking through here and you just sort of think about the history of this place when you're coming through and walking through to your office right inside the front door, but walking around the facility, because I know that a lot of distilleries have a lot of spirits and a lot of ghosts around them, but there's a lot of history and a lot of stories and a lot of spirits around this place.
Well, there's ghosts everywhere. I keep looking up the chimney to see if Pappy's going to drop down for Christmas. Maybe he will. I will wait quietly. People can't see this. It's a beautiful office, four wonderful windows and a big fireplace and a picture of the bullet bottle over the top of it now that our daughter Hollis painted. When I walk around here, I'm stunned at what this place is. A typical distillery in most places tends to be a relatively sort of an industrial type of facility. I think Maker's Mark is singularly not. It's a wonderful experience, for instance, in a very bucolic setting. This distillery was built in, 1937 or so, and it was, it dates back way before that, but the part of it we're in dates from about the 1930s. And it was built very specifically, as you saw when you came in the gate, to the boulevard. There's a primary boulevard. On the left, there are tents, 10, one next to the other, 5 in a row, Soldier Road warehouses, beautiful warehouses. This building is Jeffersonian architecture. Behind it, historically, was the government house, the tax people, the Treasury Department. Behind that is the still and then the bottling house, and then there are maybe 60 acres or so here on the property and maybe 70 or 80 buildings. So it's a very substantial property. But I think what really sets this apart and what visitors will be very interested in seeing is how the industry historically, when they stopped and thought about it, wanted to present the industry.
How so?
Well, because as you come into the primary and the question was, what does it make me feel like? I'm getting to that. It's hard to tell I'm a lawyer, isn't it? So I think the boulevard, the way they Soldier Road, the big warehouses, this beautiful Jeffersonian architecture that is absolutely unique. Those are solid 8x8 bricks that literally constitute the structural aspects of the walls, exterior and interior. So the building will literally roll over. As opposed to fall down. It makes me feel like whenever I'm out on the property, I recall my youth. It smells like youth. It feels like youth. I grew up working in the distilleries. So it harkens back to there. It's specifically, I worked in the Burnham Distillery for a number of years when I was in school and then in different places down in Bardstown where most of our family are. But it just has a which I think would be really fun for people to see ultimately, because most of us work nowadays in cubicles or in offices or in towers or in satellite office communities or buildings off of the interstate. So very few people are familiar with industrial type activities. And while we are a tiny small batch and all the bourbons are very handcrafted and wonderful, it is an industrial sort of facility. You have the big warehouses and people in their blue shirts and their stuff working very hard. And as a matter of fact, there's right behind this building, there's literally a gym which makeshift weights. At one point, they were rotating the barrels. They had to be big and strong, not to look good for the ladies, but in fact to move the barrels. And so they would work out here. And a lot of the work now is done by small machines and lifting things. We still rack here, as they all do, three racks per floor, 7 floors. So I think it has wonderful industrial sort of feeling that nobody can really. That most people don't see.
And sometime in the next 2 to 3 years, this will actually open up to the public. In this office where you're working now and where Pappy worked and his father worked before him, can you see a day when Hollis or Tucker might be in this office?
Well, you see all sorts of things for your children.
And we should point out that Hollis is one of the brand ambassadors alongside you working for Bullet. So.
Absolutely. Hollis is a little older. She's older than she's in her 30s, and she's worked for us for about the last 5 years. She went to school up east, and so she lived in the East Village and has a wonderful rapport with the bartending and mixology community. She now lives in downtown Los Angeles in a place called The Brewery, by some definition, one of the larger art communities in the United States with 300 artists. So she is very much involved in traveling around right now. She is in Reno today as we speak, doing brand ambassadorship. Our son Tucker has expressed interest. He is 19, so he can't work for us in the U.S. until he's 21. But he did spend 6 weeks at Glen Kinchy this summer working in their still over there and doing shift work and had a wonderful time, and I think learned a whole lot. So I can absolutely see them here. I think whether that comes true or not, sometimes I absolutely saw A's that turned out to be C's. But you can't tell, but I'm hopeful that they will follow. It's a wonderful business, as you know.
And for those who have not heard past episodes, you were actually on one of the very early episodes of WhiskeyCast, and we talked about the history of the brand or about the history of your family, because you really revived the brand. But I believe, correct me if I'm wrong on this, great great grandfather or great 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 grandfather Augustus Bullet.
Two greats. Fred Noe would say three greats. There are seven generations. We're about six now. Might be eight with Fred's kids. But we go great great grandfather Augustus Bullet. He would have called himself Augustus Boulay, and my great grandfather John Joseph changed it, I guess, with the broad presumption that they would kill all the Boulays in Kentucky. Changed it to Bullet, and very very straightforward Bullet. He distilled and Bullet is his recipe: 2/3 corn, 1/3 rye. Not real tricky, but a very high recipe, which in the industry is maybe the highest. I'm not sure. And relatively unique. Most of the bourbons would have maybe 12% or 14% rye. Then, of course, Maker's Mark, has a wonderful sweetness to it and smoothness. It's a wheated bourbon like they made here historically.
And then you revived his recipe 15, 20 years ago, right?
In the mid-80s. It's been almost 25 years. Maybe it is 25 years ago. Yeah, we revived it exactly 25 years ago, brought it back, and it's been just lightning these quick 25 years. So it's been a wonderful 25 years. The more recent years have been a little more comfortable. I very distinctly remember Betsy asking me with some regularity, "Now, Tom, tell me again, how are we going to pay this money back?" So it's the money's paid back, and we're doing okay now. We've just, as you are aware, we've just launched a rye. American rye, which is 5 to 7 year old, great American rye whiskey. That would be the current generation. Hollis and I worked on that. She's an artist. She did the artwork, adapted our bottle, and then pulled the color of the label from the Pantone chart. You know what a Pantone chart is? You do?
Yeah.
I'm about the only person in the world who doesn't know what a Pantone chart is.
And for reference, for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what a Pantone chart is, it's a color chart that artists and printers and photographers and anybody who works in graphics can use, so that if you refer to a Pantone color, everybody's on the same page and singing from the same choir sheet. So let's just sort of explain that real quickly, just for anybody who might have questions, so that nobody has to email that question and we have to address it later on. But if I remember right, that's what, a 95% rye?
It is. It's 95% rye, 5% malted barley, 90 proof patented yeast strain. Has a wonderful water source up in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. The still was specifically built atop a 2-million-year-old ancient glacial aquifer that has all but an inexhaustible supply of 58-degree limestone-filtered water, wonderful water. And then back to earlier in the conversation, we were talking about the people, Greg Metz, the master distiller up there. He's a wonderful man. He graduated from the University of Cincinnati in 1978. He came to work over there 1 week later, and he's still there as master distiller. Unbelievable expertise.
Now, I have to ask you, what has been more pleasurable or more enjoyable for you, practicing law for so many years or making whiskey for 25?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think the fact if after you know how to do something, then you enjoy it. And I think people will say, oh, this must be much more fun than practicing law. And I think it is more fun. I travel incessantly now. As you know, I'm on the road 140 days a year plus maybe, and doing some international travel now. But I think I practiced law for a long time. And, of course, it's a great deal of effort to get there. I went to have a graduate degree in law, as a matter of fact. So it was something that ultimately you know how to do. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed it. It offers everything as benefits and burdens. I was able to, we worked long hours. I was able to come home every night and be with the family. And now I travel a lot, and so I'm on the phone and on the Skype and stuff like that with the family. But I love this business. I've always loved this business. Our family has been in and out of it for generations, and it's a huge friendly industry. I would certainly say that you're very well aware of that. As you know, everybody's dear friends. We were just downtown. Elmer T. Lee was just given a wonderful award in Icons of Whiskey, and he's a dear, I want to congratulate him. Elmer's a wonderful old friend, an old friend of mine. Not that he's old, he's a little older than I am, and that's really rare to find somebody older than I am. But I want to offer him his congratulations. He gave a bunch of wonderful rewards to our brothers in the industry here in Kentucky.
Where do you see this brand and your family's history 25 years from now, since you're celebrating your 25th year? Where do you see Bullet Bourbon 25 years from now?
Well, I see one of the things I've really liked about, we'll always be a small brand, I think, as a small batch bourbon, a small batch rye will always be a relatively small brand. But what I really wanted to do a long time ago when I wrote a business plan, and know how to do that 25 years ago, was that I wanted really broad distribution. And we're Bullet's available in all 50 states in the United States, which is kind of unique, like a lot of products are. And we're involved, we're in about 12 or 14 countries internationally now, and we're expanding. That was a huge component. So I see us growing internationally as far as distribution goes, some volume, but certainly growing internationally. I was just in Mexico City a couple of weeks ago, launching Bullet down in Mexico, and my gosh, they're doing just a wonderful job. If you go on Google and Google Bullet in Mexico, you'll see some really interesting graphics and bylines. And then last week, we're at Whiskey Live, of course, up in Toronto, where we have a nice market, and hopefully we'll bring in the rye there within the next few months. Always had a nice market in Australia and England. And so I see the business in 25 years from now having a larger international distribution and probably a larger domestic presence.
You'll find my tasting notes for Bullet Bourbon and Rye at the WhiskeyCast website. By the way, what is said to be the last remaining stocks of whiskey distilled at Stitzelweller are not being sold by Diageo or the Van Winkles. McLean & Kine acquired those casks a couple of years ago and has been selling them under its Jefferson's Reserve label as 17- and 18-year-old editions. Is there still Stitzelweller bourbon aging in a warehouse somewhere in Kentucky? Anything's possible, but anyone who knows isn't talking. It's going to be an interesting week when the youngest whiskey you taste is 35 years old. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you this time around by Villeroy & Bock and its fine flavor line of whiskey glassware. I mentioned the Highland Park 1976 Orcadian vintage earlier, and it's the baby of the bunch this week, again bottled at 49.1% ABV. The nose is fruity with honeydew, melon, and mango notes, a buttered popcorn touch, and notes of heather and gorse from the field. The taste is floral with heathery touches, honey, coconut, and almonds, and the finish has dried flowers, honey, and just a hint of wood. It's outstanding. I'm scoring the Highland Park 1976 a 95. I brought home from Whiskey Life Paris a couple of samples from the Nectar of the Daily Drams range of independent bottlings. The Macduff 38-year-old is bottled at 47.8% ABV. I don't often think of whiskey in terms of colors, but red came right to me with this one. The nose has red apples along with heather and dried flowers. The taste is creamy with mild spices, honey, and a great apple pie note, and the finish is smooth and lingering. I'm scoring the Nectar of the Daily Dram's Macduff 38-year-old a 91. And finally, the 40-year-old Glenfarclas is bottled at 46% ABV and has those classic notes of figs, raisins, dark chocolate, brown sugar, and molasses on the nose. The taste is creamy and smooth with honey, lemon peel, a hint of black tea, and figs. The finish is long, smooth, and warms you up gently. Just a great whiskey, especially on a cold night. I'm scoring the Glenfarclas 40-year-old a 94. The One I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you this time around by Villeroy and Bock. The fine flavor line of whiskey glassware is available at fine retailers worldwide and online at the Villeroy and Bock eShop. Click the banner at the WhiskeyCast website for more details. Villeroy and Bock, glasses worthy of your whiskey. My tasting notes are available in the free apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple version is brought to you by the Glenrothes, while the Android version is brought to you by Benromic. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links for our Facebook community page and my Twitter feed, too. The calendar of events, the photo gallery, the WhiskeyCast store, powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. I'd love to hear from you. Support for WhiskeyCast comes from Redbreast Single Pot Still Irish Whiskey. Find out more at RedbreastWhiskey.com and join the Stillhouse to get your own personalized whiskey journal. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.